Hello, you lovely lot. I wanted to take a moment to share an exciting announcement with you all. I will be doing a live show for Happy Mum, Happy Baby at the Podcast Show in London on the 22nd of May. This will be a live episode of this very podcast featuring me and a very special, soon to be announced, guest. Get ready for a candid conversation, unfiltered truths, laughs, invaluable non-judgmental advice, and lived experiences. Dive into the complexities of parenting while juggling work, relationships, and personal growth. And we'll be talking beyond the baby years. As well as the live episode, the show will also include a Q&A with both me and my guest. Tickets go on sale this Friday the 26th of April at 10 a.m, but anyone who is part of the Happy Mum Happy Baby newsletter will be getting early access to tickets on Wednesday the 24th of April at 10 a.m. To sign up to the newsletter and for more information about the event, please head to happymumhappybaby.com/events. I can't wait to see you there.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to a very special Christmas episode of Happy Mum, Happy Baby, the podcast. For the first time ever, I have bubbles in the studio, so who knows where this might go. And I've been given it by Mr. and Mrs. Christmas themselves, the founders of Lapland UK. It's Mike and Alison Battle. Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for having us.
I mean, I feel like we couldn't do a special Christmas episode without you two.
Well, we are Mr. and Mrs. Lapland, and I've even worn my Christmas red jumper today to try and be festive, and we've come from the forest, but where would we rather be?
Although you're wearing a red festive jumper because the last time we were together with Tom, the three of you who are all of the Christmas helpers, essentially, were all in black.
Yes, we were, and you took a photo of us to say, look at you three, so that's why I've made such an effort
today.
We'd
like to think we've upped our game. I bought champagne, Alison's got a red jumper.
We're trying.
How are we doing,
Jim?
I know it was a hard four before, but hopefully we'll get a seven this time.
It's hard in the forest, you know. We have to just wear what we've got. Yeah. It's usually wellies and a raincoat.
Yeah, I love that. Well, I feel like I've kind of nabbed you at a really busy time of year as well, though. Is this just a nice little chance for you to have a morning off?
Yes. It's we went home last night, so we actually put some Christmas decorations up in our own house. So people always say, must be the Christmassy, you know, most Christmassy house. We're lucky if we manage to get a Christmas tree up normally at home. But we did that last night, so we're feeling very festive.
Yeah, we've got an amazing team, haven't we, now? And, we've been around a while, and we built that team up, and they've really got the spirit of what we're trying to do. And, it's quite joyful to be at site, because you get an awful lot of parents and families, and particularly those grandmothers. They all come up to me and Alison. They often want to hug Alison. Oh, they sort of do the drive-by where they whisper, thank you so much for creating this. So it's a really joyful moment. Yeah.
Well, I guess because you have been working away all year, it's quite nice to be there to see the magic.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because we spend all year planning, and there's nowhere else I want to be actually other than at that event once it's up and running, because every family is different. So it's just being there and seeing the absolute joy. Why would we want to be anywhere else?
You know, it's so
six
true.
Weeks.
I love it.
It is magical.
It absolutely is. Let's talk about you guys as parents today and celebrate you two in that way. Because I want to go right the way back to welcoming your own brood, because actually there are some similarities, but you've got one step further. So you've got four boys, with the newer set being a set of twins.
Yeah, exactly. So if we were to have your scenario, we would have two boys and then identical twins on the end. So, yeah. So we didn't intend it that way.
Let's unpack that. Was that third? Because our third was like a happy accident. Was that kind of like a...
No, we never cracked the girl thing. We went for the third, two beautiful boys, went for the third for a girl and got twin boys.
But we always said we wanted four children, so... We'd always said from early on that four children is the number that we wanted, and I just, in my head, thought that would be a mix of girls and boys. You don't think four, you're going to get one sex. But, yeah, so we had the two, and I presumed when the twins were coming along they were girls. I thought all along they'd be girls, but no, four boys.
But it was quite a story when we found out, wasn't it, Alison?
About the twins. Do you want to go back to the earlier
Let's go back.
What, back when we met at 18? You mean that?
Did you meet 18?
You mean did.
Yes. I was still at school and my sister had an engagement party and her fiancé, well, actually it was her 21st birthday, her fiancé brought his brother and friends along and Mike was one of the friends, so I met him there.
There we go. Been together ever since, pretty much, yeah.
Did you ever think, you know, looking into the future, that you would have a family in the life that you have now?
We're very aligned in the sort of ambition of a family. I'm the fifth child of five Irish family.
Right.
And Alison is Alison, so she was very, very committed and couldn't wait.
Did you come from a big family as well?
No, so I have one sister.
Right.
She's 2 years older than me, but my family are very child-focused. So Christmas was always 12, 15 people in the house, big family holidays to Cornwall, which we kept going with aunts and uncles, grandparents, everybody. So there was always a crowd around. And my parents were very focused on us girls having the best, you know, in terms of family time, and not financially necessarily, but just in terms of experience and being together. And to the extreme, for example, so when my sister was three, I think, Mum and Dad took her on holiday to the Lake District, and she said no, she much preferred Cornwall, where we'd been the year before. So they drove all the way from the Lake District down to Cornwall.
That's
to
madness.
Take her back.
That was Mike, just stay there, be grateful.
Yeah.
They were strict on expectations of behaviour and politeness and values, but no, we always had a big crowd, but just one sister.
Did that give you... Having parents who would do things like that, did that give you an air of sort of spontaneity within parenting, do you think, and kind of rolling with it?
For us, probably I saw that more from Mike's family because he was one of five. It was much more you do what you can and you roll along in a kind of a chaos. And I rather liked that, whereas my family being two, it's sort of, all the girls have had a fallout, we ruled the house kind of thing. And whereas with five, there was always... somebody to go to and somebody else to play with. And I wanted that with my family. I wanted to have a kind of chaos and sense of nobody's more important than the other one and you all just sort of get on and do your best.
Yeah, I guess with five, you can't have that time to focus on the one. Things happen. Kids, like, you know, they'll sort it out.
It's like, well, I suppose it's like when you have your first child, your second child, third child. Every one of them experiences for them... the child and for you is different because you've changed.
Yeah.
And that's it. You know, like, it wasn't the same and so on, but you change. And the thing with a big family, as Alison said, is that you experience a big family. And I always remember as a child, as I used to say to Alison, you were always important and you were loved, but you were never that important either. And if you weren't a bit, you know, huffity-puffity and said, oh, I'm not playing, everyone would go, okay, because there's another three other to play with. So then you sort of soon go, oh, well, that's not really working out, is it? So then you get back in and play football or whatever it was doing, you know? So it's quite healthy to sort of probably construct, to build a personality that feels... important, but not that important, which is probably where we all probably need to be.
Yeah, that does sound good. So when you two came together, like you got together and you got married, when you thought about having a family, was it instantly a large family? That was the goal?
Yeah, I think so. It was always in my mind four.
Really?
So, yeah, I'd had two, you were five. This seemed to be a nice kind of balance. So yeah, four was the number.
Yeah. And did things happen for quite quickly?
Incredibly.
Oh, really?
So we have been unbelievably lucky in that department. Every single time we said it's time for a baby, I was pregnant the next month.
Yeah, not much warm-up games.
No, that's not fun, is it, Mike?
I'd run on the pitch, the ball hit me on the back of the head and go in the game, go in the goal, and then I'd be back on the bench again.
No, but to the point that I was an infant school teacher at the time, and we planned it so that all of the boys were autumn starters because I knew that the older children obviously had an advantage in the classroom.
Yeah.
And all of our boys literally bang, 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 all autumn starters, all within a month.
Wow. Yeah.
Oh, very, very blessed.
I know, incredibly blessed. No miscarriages, no interventions, everything just very, very lucky.
But we did. It did come to us, though, in that we had four under four and a half.
Yeah, so we were busy. We were busy, but getting them wasn't a difficulty.
Yeah.
No. Although you did have some interesting birthing adventures, didn't you?
Doesn't everybody? Doesn't everyone? Is every birthing story is special, isn't it?
Were they all really, really different to each other?
Yes, yes, very much so. So Michael, the first one, so he's 30 now. I was quite nervous about giving birth, so I had decided that I wasn't going to be a martyr to it and I was going to have an epidural. I'd made this decision, and we live quite close to the hospital where he was due to be delivered, and I had the TENS machines at home, so I thought I'll stay at home as long as I possibly can because it's going to be 10 minutes across the road. And in fact, my mum popped in at 6 p.m. at night and I was having regular contractions, but I didn't want her to know because I thought, she's only going to worry, there's nothing she can do about it, so made her a cup of coffee and went into the kitchen and was sort of leaning on the table and waited for her to go and put the TENS machines on and stayed at home till 11 o'clock. And then I said to Mike, I think it's time to go in. So he did the classic thing of got in the car, no petrol.
Oh, no.
So we had to go to this
state.
The hospital was only 10 minutes there, walk. So we have to go out of our way to get to the petrol station, get to the hospital. And I'm 4 centimetres dilated. So I'm doing quite well. Yes, please, I'll have the epidural. So in I go, have the epidural. And then I had a very unusual and rare complication of an epidural called Horner's syndrome.
Right.
Which meant that basically, if you like, the paralysis went to my face and not to the bottom.
Went up.
Went up and not down. So it's an interruption of the neurological pathway between the brainstem and the sympathetic nerve system, which interrupts your face. And in effect, as I say, I had Botox before anyone had ever heard of it. So I was frozen up there, but not where I needed to be.
And people were obviously aware.
So,
because could you talk and make sounds and everything?
Not really. Not really.
It's quite slurry.
Not really. So at that point, obviously, they couldn't top up the epidural because I'd had this reaction. So that they went to go and get gas and air canisters, which hadn't been in my birthing plan. I hadn't had that in my thoughts at all. And the canisters arrived and they were empty. They didn't have any gas or air. And there was this really lovely West Indian midwife called Gladys, and she had 8 children of her own. And all I remember is her screaming in my face, Alison, this is the way of the Lord. This is the way of the Lord. Yeah. And I'm frozen on top, got no pain relief at all because the gas wasn't working.
Yeah.
Had to have my waters broken, had to have an episiotomy, and then out came Michael. So it wasn't the best start.
No, and how long until your face came back?
Like,
how long until you could actually talk? It's still well, fresh.
So that first night wasn't great. I remember not really being quite with it. I remember when he was born and they said, do you want to hold him and everything? I just remember thinking, Mike, you take him. And I couldn't say that, but Mike took him. And I remember the first night he had to go off into the nursery. So it was a sad start, really, and unexpected.
It's that thing, isn't it? When you've got a birthing plan, you've got expectations of, even without a birthing plan, you have expectations of what that moment's going to be like. And when anything else happens, it can be.
Yeah, yeah. But within a day, you know, I was back to normal and getting on with being a new mum.
Wow. I mean, that must have had an effect on the second time round, because obviously you would have been worried about.
Exactly. Exactly. So within 2 years, we had our next son, Matthew. You've seen Matt. He's 6'4", very, very tall, very long legs.
And single.
And single, yes. Yeah.
Just putting it out there. Yeah. There you go. Just helping out.
Exactly.
Thanks for that. I'll tell him that.
Very tall, good-looking guy. Yeah. You'll find him in Lapland.
Got it all going on. With the long legs that he had, even in my womb. So when it was time for him to turn in the womb, he got his legs stuck. So one leg was up in front of his face and the other one was downwards. So the doctor drew a little picture and said he's called the dancing baby because he's like doing this weird ballet movement. So for that reason, I had to have an elective cesarean with him because I couldn't have delivered this position.
Do you think you would have been quite relieved following the epidural of the time before? Were you anxious about what you would have experienced?
Not really, because I hadn't put my headspace into the thought of an operation at all.
Right.
You know, cesarean is a fairly big deal, isn't it?
Yeah.
So to me, I was still going to give birth naturally.
Yeah.
So it was quite worrying, certainly at that time. And I started reading up all about cesarean and so on. On the day, it was decided that I would have a spinal block. So in I went on the day. And you remember this, Mike?
The doctor
said, Mike, will you hold Alison while we do all the numbing and prepare for the spinal block? And then what happened?
Well, it didn't go well for me. That's the main thing.
Oh, no.
I went a bit green and then they made me sit down and all that type of thing.
No!
So complete lightweight. But anyway.
So all that time when the focus goes away from mum. Let's sort this out.
You saw the needle come in
totally
and that was
rubbish,
it. So basically, they put the spinal block in and again it didn't work. So again, I had some weird neurological reaction and all I remember it was as though I'd been stabbed 3 times. The pain was excruciating.
Yeah.
So they knocked me out straight away with a general. So that was Matthew's arrival.
Wow.
Number two.
That's only number two.
Halfway there.
But, I mean, that must be such a surreal experience to wake up and your baby be there.
Yeah. I don't remember, obviously. I think
the whole experience would, because you're in that medical sort of space, but it's that sort of twilight zone because there's nothing wrong with you in that you're having a baby, but you sort of suddenly went into this like ER moment where all this serious stuff and the energy just changed in the air and everything became very serious.
Yeah.
And then your focus, well, not that I've got any much to do with it, but your mindset is everything going to be okay?
Yeah.
You know, all of that planning, all of that, it's sort of, it just vaporizes.
Also,
you're
saying you don't have a lot to do with it. You absolutely do, because that's your wife who you're seeing is giving birth to the baby. But if she's being knocked out and all that, that's a really scary place to be. That's not a very natural place for any of us.
Yeah,
a situation for us to be in.
It's. I think Tatra would never had this, but it's you're getting that medical sort of demonstrative experience where it's like an ambulance or something's happening to your partner and you can see your loved one there, but you don't really understand it. So you've got all these questions but you can sense the energy that stuff is going down or they are working to get you to a better place. But you're fundamentally not in a good place that you're working to. So it is not a nice experience, really.
No. So what was it like when you came round? Were you back in a nice area with your baby by your side?
Yes, I was back on a ward. I was just in the local hospital, back on a ward, and there was a baby in a little plastic cot next to me.
I mean, and also, I guess when you come round, people don't know when you're going to come round. So it's not like someone's going to be right in your face going, hello, this is...
Yeah, but as Mike said, it almost becomes not about having a baby at that moment. It's just kind of survival in a way. You know, you just want to...
It's a moment,
get your partner through this moment, and then you can have the joy of the baby's fine and everybody's okay. But,
And the medical staff are all incredible, but you do sort of go into this tunnel
unknown.
And then come out the other
it's
side of
unknown.
It and then your life has forever changed again because you have a child and all of that. But the tunnel bit wasn't fun for anybody involved, because obviously particularly for Alison, of course, but you are in that sort of worry zone. You're not really quite sure. And as I said, all of the sort of well-laid plans all just vaporise and you're just, can you get through this and come out the other side of it healthy and so on?
All I do remember when I came round is that I thought he would be a girl because I've got a boy and now's the girl. So I remember the midwife saying, "What's the baby's name?" And I said, "Betty." Because we always thought Betty Battle, that sounds quite sweet. Betty Battle, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
I said, no, it's a boy. So
there we go.
I wonder, there's some great names that are unisex. I wonder if Betty could be up there as kind of like a...
Yeah.
Here's Betty.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's all those names that you have as a couple that they just never land because the boy or the girl comes and there you go.
We've had girls the whole way through, and they're just, there's never going to be a Poppy or a Sylvia. That's just never going to happen.
My mum is Sylvia.
Oh, well, we met a Sylvia at yoga school, so we thought a Sylvia or Sylvie would be really
lovely.
Thing.
Yeah. Sylvia is a very cute name, and you don't hear
really
it.
It's cute. Mm. But it wasn't to be. We had a Maxwell instead.
Lovely.
There you go.
Yeah.
All good.
Yeah, all good.
Those names are still running.
they are.
Aren't they, Jean?
So obviously you didn't. So coming back around, you've got two at this point now. How did life change with the two?
Well, I was very, very lucky because for the first 5 years of parenting, Mike worked at home.
Right.
I chose to work at home.
He chose to work at home. So he was stock market man back then, what would you call it?
I think that's quite official. Stock market man.
Stock market.
You don't need to know anything else.
My journey was I'd worked in the city in lots of, big institutions and things like that. And I'd sort of seen the future pace of it, where a lot of these guys were on their second or third marriage and that they missed everything.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really having that. So I chose to go independent. And then I also chose to go home because I didn't want to miss one nativity. I didn't want to miss one tooth and all that type of thing. So as I said, it's funny our story now, that all these little moments that sort of give you little signposts to how your life would turn out. But that was an unusual thing to do.
And I think still now, I think I think especially people that work in the city, you get that job, you're on that, that
treadmill,
it's on that treadmill. And I think things like the nativity, they get lost. It's just seeing that is what you do.
Mm. But I think in many ways I would champion Alison for this, is that she was a great believer and cognitive and conscious of it won't last long.
Yeah.
And you only get these moments once. So if you miss them, they're never going to be there again.
Yeah.
So that, I suppose, had come to me as a man and as a person. And I think Alison's right. This sort of fleeting childhood time that we have with our children is so special. And I know, obviously, people have to work and make a living for their family and all that. But I was in a privileged position. I could come home and I worked from home. And as I said, I never missed a thing.
So how was that juggle, though, working from home and with having young ones in the house?
Initially, it was pretty good. It was a bit weird because the nature of doing the work, you'd be sitting in front of like 8 screens.
Right.
So then I would hear Alison struggling and then my instinct would be to go and help. But I knew I shouldn't be helping because I'm working. And so that wasn't really very good. We bobbed along quite well. In the end, to completely, in some ways, contradict myself, when the twins came along.
I mean, twins are a different story.
It was like Premier League of chaos, So I got an office a little bit away from the house, and then I used to commute to that and then come back. And in actual fact, that was quite a funny time because myself and Alison, we were sort of under the cosh of the four of them. We used to play this game like, who's had the worst day?
Oh, really?
And there was a particular one where we just cracked up laughing between us because I was coming back from London and the trains were all in a mess and I ended up basically nestling under this guy's armpit on the journey home.
Wow.
And it was like 400 degrees and all this type of thing. So then I come home feeling slightly sorry for myself, going, oh, you wouldn't believe what happened to me. And then Alison comes straight out going, all right for you sitting there with your own thoughts, At least you can
yourself.
Go to the toilet on your own, So, we used to play that game, but anyway.
I love the fact that sitting on the scene eating someone else's sweaty armpit is better.
Yes.
That that's the better option.
Yeah, all right for you.
It's the freedom. That was the better option. The moment of, you know, you can choose to move down the train. You haven't got four little people that you're looking out for all day long.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the arrival of the twins. Well, first of all, let's talk about finding out that you were having twins.
Yeah.
How was that?
Well, that was very interesting again, because I went to our local hospital, walked over on my own and had the dating scan. And they said February the 14th, one baby. So I thought I was having one baby.
Yeah.
And it was quite an old-fashioned sort of device.
Like a black and white TV.
Crackly and, you know, so, okay. So February the 14th, another baby on the way. And then they got in touch with me and said, we're doing this sort of survey research into the nuchal scan, where they measure the fold in the back of the neck to see potential for Down syndrome.
Right.
Would you like to take part in this sort of research? And I said, yeah, that's fine. Would you go to King's College Hospital on Denmark Hill for it? So I said, well, Mike, you know, you're going to have to drive me there because, you know, I'm not confident doing that one. So he came with me and they sat me down and they did the scan. And
But now we had like a plasma screen
ever
compared to
the moment.
Black and white.
It was like state of the art technology. And I'm there being scanned. They turned on this monitor and as clear as day, it was like two little dolphins flipping around on the screen.
Yeah. And the
doctor said, you do know there are twins here, don't you? And Mike did that classic, I need a seat. Yeah. You know,
I'm coming across
chair
as a complete lightweight in this.
Yeah, it's not boding well so far. So how many weeks were you by this point?
16.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the third child, but in actual fact, so we sort of you get, you know what you're doing sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was, yeah, I remember seeing, because I remember seeing the two and going, what is that? And then the guy said, you do know there's two children here.
But especially because I'd had the dating scan at 12 weeks and I thought one baby and suddenly, no, there are two. So.
And even by 12 weeks, they're both, you know, that's the substantial baby
well, exactly.
in there, you know.
So I said, what happened? And they said, well, one must have been hiding behind the other.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was fascinating, actually, Alison's reaction to that.
Okay.
Because she was ecstatic, absolutely ecstatic. Yeah. And she was literally going along.
Maybe it was shock.
Yeah, but you were going along.
I got the giggles. Yeah. I had to stop the scan. I know that because I was laughing so much.
Really?
They couldn't get any more reading from me.
Yeah, but you were ecstatic.
And then I remember walking back to the car along Denmark Hill and I was saying to Mike, all of these people in all of these cars, they don't know I've got twins.
Because it's that life-changing moment that's about to happen for you guys.
And what was so remarkable about that announcement was so different from any other. So there are lots of children in our family, 16 grandchildren on that side. So it's always lovely, the announcement of a new baby, obviously. But when it was twins, it was a whole new excitement around it, to the point that I felt the responsibility of carrying them to get them safely delivered, because there was so much excitement about these twins that were going to suddenly be in the family.
Yeah. Well, how did the kids react to there being
two new ones? Very, very funny. So, in fact, when they were born, because I was reading my newborn diaries last night, ready for today, and I kept all, as I do, and when the boys came into the hospital to meet their new brothers, so Michael, the eldest one, quite sensitive, hello, baby brothers. Matthew, the lad, want to come and live in our house? And he wasn't even to himself. He was just to himself.
Yeah.
Want to come and live in our house?
Yeah, it was amazing.
So, no, they've always been great. Oh, you're tearing up thinking about them. But they've been fantastic as big brothers. In fact, all four of them are brilliant. But, so then suddenly we had four little ones in the house.
So, well, how was the arrival after the previous two? I mean, this is, again, it's a brand new experience. We know that birth doesn't follow one set pattern anyway, but it's a different again because it's twins.
Yeah. So because I'd had this cesarean with Matthew only 2 years prior, they said it was the safest option to have an elective cesarean. Often twin pregnancies, the second one can become distressed and it becomes an emergency cesarean. So I was booked in for the elective cesarean, and that was bizarre because we walked into the theatre holding two little nappies thinking there's going to be two little babies in here in half an hour, which is totally surreal. And of course I was very nervous about the spinal block again because that was what had been booked. And reading my diaries again last night, it said that I was sort of had to curl up in a ball and Mike wasn't invited in this time.
Probably safest.
Yeah. Stay outside. And it said that I was curled up in a ball and I was shaking and I was sweating and I was terrified as they were coming at me with the spinal block. And it said that the anaesthetist said, you're to expect a small electric shock. And it said in my diary that I experienced three quite painful ones to the point that I shouted out, is this going wrong again? And then everything blocked and it was fine. So the spinal worked and I was awake. So they put the screen up and Mike was there.
Yep.
And they allowed do
back
their
in the room.
Thing.
Yep.
Yeah, ready. He was all dressed in his greens. So he's in his surgical greens and a fetching little cap. And yeah, so then they do their thing and out came baby number one, 6 pounds, 3 ounces. Out came baby number two, 6 pounds, 13.
That's a good weight for twins, isn't it?
Yeah, they were good.
It was completely surreal as well because I was there in the medical greens and they handed you one baby and you had that and you had another arm free and then they handed you the second baby.
So instantly you're in the mode of,
I've got that photo. Yeah. It's brilliant. Mike in his greens with one under each arm.
And it's like, this is new.
You're really showing you what the juggle's going to be like.
Yeah. One, and okay, you ready? And the second one.
Did it feel really, really different?
100%. Everything about it. So I had breastfed the other two boys and intended to do with these, but I never managed to synchronise breastfeeding. And though I kept it up for 6 months, it was always one and then the other. You know, everything was different about two. It wasn't like going from a singleton to two children. It was a whole new world. It was a whole sort of management of risk and choosing almost.
Well, because people always say about twins, they just literally would like to run in opposite directions.
They did the time. And we would literally do a quick risk analysis of that one. If we get to that one, he's going to fall down the steps. But if we get to that one, he's only going to fall on the grass. And we'd make these kind of split decisions.
Your brains would be processing all of that and going, grass, concrete. Okay, I'll go for the concrete. He can fall.
and even with feeding them, I remember thinking, because one would be crying all the time waiting for his turn. And I had to change my mindset to think he's singing to me, you know, he's calling to me, so that because you have to be relaxed to be breastfeeding and to be stressed to think that baby's crying to be fed, I had to change the way I was thinking of his communication.
Yeah. But I mean, how did you balance that with the older two who were still under four?
Still under four. So for that first year, we had four of them in the house because Micah was going to start school in the September and the twins were born in the January. So we had that long year and summer of four of them at home. Mike was at home. So that made all of the difference, really. Yeah. My parents lived at the end of the road. So that was also the reason we'd bought our house, to be near them. But other than that, I didn't want any help. I'm not somebody who wants people to see my chaos. I want to get on with it privately. So it was
that's interesting. Do you feel, because I feel like this, sometimes when there's other people around in my chaos, it makes me view my chaos differently. Yeah. I'm viewing it from their position and that's actually not helpful as a mother or a father.
Yeah. So the hospital had said that a nursery nurse, a young sort of trainee could come to the house and help and sort of see what it's like for young children to be growing and so on. I said, I'm sorry, I really don't feel I can cope with anybody else in the house. I just want to get on with it in my own mess, in my own chaos, in my own way, and we'll sort of get through. But I do remember thinking in those early days and years that a successful day was fed, bed, no injuries. That was the criteria. Yeah.
The way it used to work with Alison, though, which was very typical, Alison was very cognitive as always that this isn't going to last, and in many ways, although she was, you know, romantically breastfeeding at sunrise, she really was in that moment going, this won't last, and I will probably ache for these days one year, you know, in years to come. And the other one, I suppose, I always think with life generally, is that it's all about balance. And when we used to come home, well, I used to come home, let's say, after, you know, being under the armpit, then what I used to say to Alison was, okay, I'm here now, disappear for an hour, because she'd be, you know, at the door, like, oh, thank God you're back and all of this. So then I would say, I'm in full control. You can just do anything you like. So then Alison would disappear upstairs, have a bath or whatever. And I said, I'll see you in an hour. But Alison being Alison, within 40 minutes, minute she'd be coming down the stairs again.
Yeah.
And I'd be saying, you don't need to do this. I'm you know, you've got another 20 minutes plus, whatever, where I don't, well, I'll just take complete control of this.
Yeah.
But the thing, I suppose, and in some ways, the advice I always give to young families is it's about that moment, having that exhale. And if you just keep going harder and harder and harder, then you get really stressed out. And it was even Alison just having that moment to exhale, as I said, have a bath, just relax, yeah, watch something on the TV, feel a bit like Alison again,
fact,
and then come back
what
again.
What you ultimately did is you enforced it. So we actually had Thursday nights from 6 p.m. and all day Saturday until 2 p.m.
Right.
Mike took complete control and he didn't want me around. You know, it was like, don't, this is your time and do what you want, even if you just stay in bed until 2 whatever. But what was very remarkable about that is, one, it gave me the balance I needed just to sort of have a bath or go to the loo or whatever, you know, just to be me for that short time. But one particular story about that, which was where Mike was really remarkable, is on the Saturday mornings, it became swimming lessons.
Right.
So he used to take 4 young boys off on his own to the local swimming bars.
I'm fighting back now.
And another thing, yeah, this is a good story. So another thing with twins is you can't do what you do with a singleton. So
yeah,
I couldn't take them swimming, for example, because you physically can't safely manage 2 children at once. So they sometimes had to wait for a class to begin for them to go safely into something like swimming. So when they could join the swimming class, Mike would take them on a Saturday morning. So all 4 boys, but the twins particularly, I remember there was one occasion and they were in the swimming class. They must have been 2.5, 3, whatever age you're allowed to join a group swim session. And the teacher had all these little toddlers really swimming along, you know, across the width. And Mike noticed that Christian had become discombobulated and had gone face down.
Oh.
And the swimming instructor was still moving forward with all the other children,
no,
hadn't noticed
that Christian
was still face down. And Mike actually jumped in fully clothed over the side of the barriers and hauled the baby out.
Yeah. Got him, yeah. Oh my gosh.
Well, I just thought I could shout about it, but I remember processing.
There's nothing
I'm not a panicker.
Quicker than just
yes.
doing it.
So yeah, I remember I was in my jeans and I just went bang in and pulled him out. And
apparently everyone
good.
Cheered.
Yeah, they all cheered me at the end. So,
but
yeah.
What was the instructor doing?
God knows. But you know, that's the nature of life. There are, you know, risk assessments,
your
I suppose.
Instinct as a parent is
yeah.
just to protect
yeah.
and
yeah.
save.
Well,
but anyway, those Saturday mornings, they were quite eventful. So
yes, they were.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's talk about sort of creativity, imagination and play, because obviously that's a huge part of what you do mm-hmm. work-wise now. But with the kids growing up, how important was it for you for them to have, like, to be free with their imaginations?
Very much, because my kid's very creative, so we would do all sorts of things with them, but I would bring home what happened in the classroom as well. So whatever I've been doing, I would bring home a version for them to do at home. So we were always, you know, painting and baking and all of those lovely old fashioned things. But yeah, I think creativity and play, we weren't really into, or we didn't have screen-based things. The boys have never had a television in their bedroom, even ever. Never. Mm. So things like that. It was always about storytelling. I'm hugely into reading, so we'd be going to the local library all the time. It was imaginative play and tents in the garden and camping in the garden and all of those kinds of things. And yeah, I think they had a classic old-fashioned kind of Swallows and Amazons childhood, really.
Cornwall
in the Lake District, that's all we did.
Yeah.
My childhood, I grew up in a family where, you know, fairly humble, and I suppose that sort of creative power that I had wasn't really recognised as something of particular value.
Yeah.
So I sort of had this journey where I sort of felt I had something that had to come out inside me, but I, because the world was all very linear, very Euriva, bright or thick, let's say, if you were a great reader and things like that, then I had no real reason to continue to think that, if I'm honest. So I protected that. So then, I lived my life and so on, and some of this creativity has ultimately come out now, and I feel more me than I've ever been in my life. So taking those lessons as a father, I was always looking at the boys to sort of get insights as to what was their magic inside of them, and I still do that to this day. And when they're not confident and so on and so on, I'm always there championing them. And even the creativity thing, most of them have got it, and I always say to them, you do it quite easily, so therefore you don't value it. And they went, no, I can draw, I can paint, I can do all this stuff. But I said, that's amazing what you're doing. So my journey, I suppose, like all of us in life, but that's probably been my journey, is that I sort of had a journey to find me, let's say. I suppose we're all doing this. But my thing is, as a father, is to try and support them at an earlier stage, because although I've sort of made it through to my happy dad, let's say, a lot of people might have been, not made it, or being crushed by the system as such, and then they end up not being that happy. So, being who you're meant to be, you're very happy.
Let's go back to Christmas. When you were kids, what did Christmas look like?
As a child. So I shared a bedroom with my sister, and Father Christmas would fill a pillowcase. So I even now remember that moment of waking up on Christmas morning and looking to the end of the bed and seeing that bulging sack, pillowcase. I think it's something that never leaves you. Mm-hmm. And as I said, Mum was passionate about hosting Christmas dates, still does, 83 years old. We always had lots and lots of family, and my nan was very generous, so we would all have our sort of smaller presents, and then she would reveal the big present, and we'd go into the kitchen and there'd be a bike or an organ or something. So it was always very busy. We would go and see Dad's family, who lived in Lewisham, on Christmas morning. So Dad's family in the morning, Mum's family for the rest of the day, and lots of chaos and mad games and presents. And what the dream of Christmas, I guess.
Yeah. What was yours like, Mike?
Mine, I think, was slightly other, in that it felt quite magical. And there was a sort of, again, an atmosphere in the house that wasn't normally there. And, you'd had all the present thing, and your brothers and sisters were all there, roaring around, engaging with what they'd got under the tree and all this type of thing. But it felt very different from normal life. So I think we always say that when people come to Lapland, or Christmas generally, is that as much as it's about the children, we all remember being children, and we all remember those moments when you can feel it, that complete innocence. And and then sadly things change, I suppose, but we always remember that, and it's almost you grieve for that part of your personality. So there's something about Christmas that is
Buying into the magic. I think one of our favourite things is, obviously we've been to Lapland this weekend, one of our favourite things is seeing my kids interact with the elves, and things like that. And that
they jump a lot, your children.
Oh, my kids love a jump.
They do. They love a jump.
Jumping with happiness.
I remember dropping Buzz off at school one day, and his teacher went to him, "Still bouncing, Buzz." I was like, "Well, that's just
happy
that is
movement." I like it. Skipping and jumping.
So much energy. Yeah. It's great. Yeah.
So having had the magical Christmases that you had, that is full of the chaos and the magic, did you sort of come together when you had your own kids and kind of go, well, what do we want this to look like? And how did you create those Christmases?
I remember when we bought our house and we were renovating it, and the first year that we were in it, it wasn't quite ready for Christmas, and I turned the front room into a grotto. I remember getting
putting it was red paper.
Red sugar paper that I'd stenciled with stars, and we covered the whole of the front room in this grotto, and all of the children in the family, so the nieces and nephews, came into our grotto. So I suppose it was on the cards from early on, really.
There was definitely
something there. We wanted to make magical moments right from the get-go. We were I was very conscious of wanting to make these memories when the children were small. And even back in the day when we started going on the Father Christmas visits, which has ultimately led to Lapland, because I couldn't find anything that I felt matched the importance of this moment. and we would go to grottos up and down the country and even overseas. I would have little notes written about the boys because there was no personalisation. They didn't know the children's names or anything, so I'd write all these little notes, and the poor elf going in, I'd say, make sure Father Christmas gets that before we come through the door and make sure he's ready. So I was very keen to give them this sort of childhood magic at Christmas time.
I guess if you're heavy on wanting to create this magic, and actually then you're going to meet Father Christmas like everyone does. People talk about it, going to see Father Christmas. If that Father Christmas doesn't marry up to the magic that you've created, if it doesn't feel mysterious mythical,
believable.
Alison's is an amazing champion for children. I'm probably a born-again champion, so I'm slightly passionate about it almost more than Alison, even, because Alison is the real deal. I'm just a turn-upper and being a cheerer on her. But I always remember with Christmas with us is that it never reached what, or experiencing it with what, the level or the scale or the importance that we thought of it as. And we have this phrase now where we say, if you're a believing child or you're lucky enough as a mother and father to have that, or grandparents, it should be in your love filing cabinet. And in your love filing cabinet is your wedding day, is your graduation day, is your big birthdays with an O or something like that. When these are moments in your life, and we feel this believing moment, or having a believing person in your family of that believing moment, is in that love filing cabinet. So when Alison and I first set out to do what we do now, is we didn't want to just polish what had been there. We want to completely and utterly revolutionise it to put it in its rightful place.
Yeah, that's totally what you've done.
Thank you.
Obviously, your kids are now all grown up. Of what you've done so far in parenting, because it's not finished yet, what has been the most challenging time to navigate?
Physically, when they're young, obviously, because the demands made on you and your time. But to me, I think probably those teenage years when they're learning to drive, when they're outside of your control.
The driving thing. I was talking to someone about this the other day. The fact they can get in a car and drive somewhere.
Yeah. It's the safety element for me, because all the time they were in the house, they were tucked up, they were cozy, I knew where they were safe in bed. But when they start venturing into the world, for me that was a challenge. I was the mum that never slept until I could hear the last key and they'd all arrive back home. Not just driving, but being in London, you know, you worry about them on the streets and so on. So all of that, what's going on, clubbing. And for me, that was the most challenging time. So I'm happy now that they're towards the end of the 20s and into 30s and hopefully, you know, mature enough to handle all that life can throw at them.
So on the flip side, they've all, you know, they've flown the nest.
Yeah.
How does that feel?
In one way, it's fantastic.
Absolutely amazing. We're sat here with bubbles. I mean, life is good.
Fantastic in that we're free. You know, we're still relatively young because I'd had the four boys by 32. So we have, you know, we've got our health, thankfully, and we can do what we like now. So we've got so much freedom. The other side of the coin is, you miss them, obviously. So my greatest time is when they all come home for the roast on the Sunday, and they are still all in London. So we see a lot of them, and two of them in the business all the time. So we are very, very lucky. But I think we're really enjoying this stage in our lives now, because we feel we've done a good job with the boys. And, you know, they've flown the nest, and they are our greatest joy still, always will be. But we've got ourselves again now as well. And, you know, you have this time where you are just in the trenches doing the parenting, and now we can go on holiday without them, although they often all come with us, and we do that.
Do. Where are you going? Oh, I think we'll come.
Yeah, we do that every year as well, and now the girlfriends come as well, so 9 of us going anywhere, which is really lovely too.
But it's as it should be, G. You know, the little birds have flown the nest, and that's as you would want it to be.
Yeah.
You know, they've developed the skills and developed themselves, and they're ready for the world. So, you know, it's that in a moment of a parent where you let go, and that even though they haven't got the stabilizers on, they carry on and pedal the bike.
Absolutely.
And they're also, And the thing I love this stage, and I really do enjoy the stage, is that they sort of become friends. They're I've always, I suppose, played the role of and committed to being a father. I think there's lots of friends they have,
yeah.
And they've only got one dad. So I've always think I'm the dad or the father, and also I see it very much a role of being responsible to try and guide them as best I can. But now there is nothing greater when I, you know, go to football or have a pint with them or whatever, and it's great. And they're chatting about their lives, and I'm chatting about my life, and we have a sort of high level conversation. But it's great. I love it.
Yeah. And what about you two as a couple? Because obviously you got together at 18, Footloose, you know, lovely, lovely time, all that freedom.
A long time ago.
Yeah, and then but then you've gone through, you know, the trenches, if you like. You've had children close together, and, you know, your life essentially does become about bringing those children up. And now you're back to being you two again. How has that been? Well, I know you've got the business, but...
I would say for me, when you have children, is that you don't lose who you are.
No.
You become more. And that is part of the challenge of becoming a parent. Is it's not, you know, there's parts that you look back of your, you know, younger years and you think, what was I doing? But at the same time, you actually become more,
yeah.
And you learn more. And that's and there's nothing like growth to feel alive. So I feel it's really enriching. And I've had my best friend Alison with me through this whole journey. So
yeah.
we like every couple, we get on each other's nerves a lot. But I wouldn't have had it any other way. Genuinely,
I think we're probably like you and Tom. Actually, G, in that we don't know it any other way.
Yeah.
You know, we've always been there for each other. So this is the next chapter and we're both thoroughly enjoying it.
Yeah, and you've got to, you know, suck the juice out of that bit. You know,
yeah.
There's the early years chapter, there's the early school years, there's the this years, and now ours have all flown the nest. And as Alison said, we've got time and inclination, and as I said, blessed hope with health that we can do stuff. So yeah. Let's suck the juice out of that bit.
Absolutely.
And now I'm going to start my foundation.
No. Yeah. What's the foundation?
Yeah, so we thought about what do we have that other children's charities don't, and it's obviously Father Christmas.
Yeah.
So we are starting our foundation now, and we are going to be the company that puts a Christmas stocking on the bed of every child in a British hospital or hospice on Christmas Eve.
That's actually made me cry. Oh my God, that's so gorgeous.
We're starting
don't
this year.
That Mark. Because so we've got that, Father Christmas,
that will
haven't
be,
we?
That will be my legacy, hopefully. If your child is in hospital, that plan's there. So we're starting this year with Evelina Children's Hospital and Lewisham Hospital, and the plan is to get to 200,000 children in hospitals around the UK.
Because we feel huge responsibility to represent Father Christmas and the values that he stands for. Mm. It's not really about that land, it's about Father Christmas, you see, and the world.
No, but you've created this world, and it's about taking that out to other people that, you know, that can't get...
Look at us. Gone.
Is that champagne gone?
That's just so gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. So gorgeous. Okay, if you could write a letter to anyone about being a parent, who would it be to and what would you say?
I would write it to my boys and I would thank them for making me a parent and giving me the gift of motherhood. And I would say to them, you don't know what joys are still to come your way in parenting. And there's never a right time to be a parent. So maybe this is just me wanting to be a grandmother.
There's never a right time. So, you know.
But my granddad, for example, he had my mum when he was 17.
But on the back
of that, my mum still had him when she was 80 years old.
Yeah.
Because he died at nearly 98. So I think all this planning everybody nowadays is so sort of, I need to do that before I've done this. I think children come when they come and they are the greatest blessing whenever they arrive. So I'd write to my boys and I'd say, thank you for making me a mother and enjoy parenting when it comes to you, because you won't understand the joy it's going to bring you until it happens.
Gorgeous.
Very good. Who would I write a letter to? I would probably write a letter to those young fathers who are probably full of testosterone and, you know, trying to get it right as such. And I think they need to probably understand that they are here to be a partner and to support. And The early stage, you might not be able, of course, you can't help out physically, let's say, specifically, like breastfeeding and things like that. But at the same time, you're there to support your partner. And as we've talked about many times, I think the greatest thing I probably did for Alison was to give her a little bit of balance in her life through that time. And then also a sense when we were going through various twists and changes as a family was that we were doing it together.
Yeah.
We were always in it together. We weren't judging each other. We were always in it together, and we sort of find our way through. And the thing about, as I was saying earlier, being a father is that you don't lose who you are. You just gain more.
Yeah.
So it's an opportunity, and looking after little people and developing as a person will make you feel alive. It mm-hmm. will be the love of your life. So slightly get over yourselves and enjoy the magic of being a father.
Okay, so we end the podcast with you completing three sentences. So the first one is being a mum means and being a dad means.
You want to go?
Being a mum means waking up every day with gratitude and pride.
Being a father means you're special. You're special to a certain group of people, and you have to take huge responsibility for that role that has been that you've created.
Yeah. Next sentence.
Since having children, I have had my world expanded in so many wonderful ways that I wouldn't have experienced otherwise. So I've embraced every chapter of the boys' lives, be that going to university. One of them, they've worked overseas, they've studied overseas, and every time it's just expanded our lives, and I've really found it joyous to be on the journey with them. So they've expanded my world.
I found more in myself than I even thought I had, and that's been quite a journey, really. And these are the relationships, Alison aside, of my life.
And finally, I'm happy when
they're all home for a Sunday roast.
we're all at Palace and we're 2-0 up.
I love that. Sam, as a father of adults.
There you go.
Thank you so much. Honestly, what you do is you just create pure magic. And so thank you. Thank you, Mike Alice.
Thank you so much.
No more tears, Jean.
No more tears. No, it's all good. But if I can help in any way next year. Just
of course. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Happy Christmas, everybody.
Merry Christmas.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.